Hello and welcome to another episode of Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll, our podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies, and helps you understand how digital money and digital assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Michael Blaschke, and today we explore the banking, or rather debanking, issues of crypto SMEs. Joining today is Stefan and Markus Moleskov, Chief Risk and Compliance Officer and co-founder at Janua. Welcome, Markus.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Good morning, everybody. So let's start into the questions, Markus. We thought about learning about yourself first. So tell us a bit about your personal history and what brought you to Janua.
Yeah, so as Michael rightfully said, my name is Markus Moleskov, Chief Risk and Compliance Officer at Janua. I'm also one of the co-founders. Before founding Janua, I worked almost 8 years in banking with market and counterparty credit risk in two large Danish banks. Even before that, I took a master's in mathematical finance at Copenhagen Business School. So I have a different background from most compliance people, but I took the risk way into the compliance world. So that's, of course, interesting. The reason that I left banking to go into crypto world, it's a long story. I've always been fascinated with startups and always thought about joining a startup. And then at some point in 2016, I met our other founder, Simon, who at that point in time was doing a crypto startup. He was trying to build tokenized concert tickets using Colorcoin, which is a very, very old version of NFTs built on the Bitcoin blockchain. And he was experiencing some issues. He saw that there was no trust in the blockchain ecosystem, right? So he has a background in biology, and he later told me the story that in order to go from a desert to a forest, you cannot just start planting trees because the desert soil will not be nutrient enough or not have the capability to contain the water needed to sustain a forest. First, you need to plant grass that can then have long roots that can contain water, then you can start to plant shrubs and flowers and those kind of things. That will attract insects, which will start to cultivate the soil. After a generation with that, you can start to add, you know, bushes and small trees and those sort of things. And then they will start to attract animal wildlife, which will cultivate the soil further. And only then will the soil be capable of sustaining a forest, and you can start planting a forest. And with this knowledge of his on how ecosystem evolution works, he saw that the next step needed in order for Bitcoin to kind of evolve into something else was to facilitate trust in the industry. So he was lucky to have a shared office space with Chainalysis once they were founded. And he ended up being the first non-engineer at Chainalysis.
Okay, so that's very cool.
Yeah, so he became their head of training and customer success, and he's traveled the world educating all of the FIUs, all of the big banks, all the big exchanges on how to do on-chain analytics back in 2017. So
sounds like the perfect team for starting a crypto, crypto startup like TradFi and on-chain native co-founder. Yeah.
Exactly.
Before we go on, Markus, I'm curious about the analogy.
Yeah.
So what's Bitcoin in this biology analogy?
Well, Bitcoin 2014 is definitely the Wild West. That's the desert, right? And then again, with my banking background, I've seen how, you know, financial markets works from the inside, how much time and resources are spent on reconciliation of derivative trades and on, you know, settlement risk being held. I don't know if you know this, but in economics, you talk about GDP being money times velocity. So say I have a 100-euro note, I go to a market fair, I can buy something worth 100 euro from one stall. They now have that 100-euro note. They can go to the stall next door, buy something for 100 euro, who can then go and buy something for 100 euro. We've now created 400 euros worth of GDP using 100 euro note. So the 100 euro note is the money aspect, and the velocity is then the amount of jumps that 100 euro note does in a year. Today, we trade about $200 trillion worth of stocks in the US stock market daily, and we trade about $5 trillion worth of bonds in the US bond market daily. Stocks have 2-day settlement, bonds have 5-day settlement. So that's roughly $29 trillion that are locked in settlement any given day throughout the year. Imagine if we can compress that settlement time down to an hour or less by tokenizing the financial assets. That means that these trillions of dollars would be released into the world and creating this flywheel effect of having increased velocity. And that, for me, could create a lot of value, right? On top of that, you have all the banks who are holding capital against these settlement risk and those kinds of things, and those settlement risk will come down. That means the banks will have to hold less capital. That means they can lend out more, which again creates a flywheel effect for increasing economic activity. So I saw this and realized that tokenized financial assets, that's my forest. Personally, there's other people who have, you know, a Bitcoin-based economy as their forest. But for me, tokenized financial assets, that's my forest. That's where I want to go, and that's where I see blockchain leading to, and that being the big game changer of the world for blockchains.
You improved that pitch considerably after we met 2 years ago when I interviewed you for the Institutional DeFi study. But Marcus, yeah, you had a similar story at the time, but I think it's even more perfect by now.
I've said it a few times since then, so I've perfected the story.
But with that forest in mind, I think the listeners will be curious. So what did you do then? So what's January all about? Yeah. How do you cultivate that forest actually?
Yeah, so to do that, we have to take a step back. And that is then where me and Simon meet each other, right? So me and Simon meet each other. He's done a Chainalysis, and he's, while traveling around the world educating crypto exchanges, he's seen that there are some crypto exchanges who are doing what he calls compliance theater, right? So they're just acting like they're trying to prevent financial crime, but in this essence, you know, it's just a front. And then you have crypto exchanges who are actually trying to combat financial crime. And what he saw was that banks were not able to differentiate the two. So they would just offboard or reject financial infrastructure to the two crypto exchanges the same, as if they were the same. So with his knowledge of the industry, you know, and my knowledge of banking, and we had someone else who was a AML professional also from the banking side, you know, we went together, and then we created Januar to solve this debanking issue, and we still believe today that we are some of the best in the world at separating, at risk assessing crypto companies and separate good for the bad, so that we can provide financial infrastructure for the legitimate part of the industry while making sure that the criminal entities of the crypto industry does not get a ramp to offboard their illicit gains.
Okay, so which leads me to the question, who are your typical clients? So who do you serve actually today?
Yeah, so our typical clients are small and medium-sized crypto exchanges and brokers. So we have a lot of brokers who, you know, have their own website, and they need an IBAN or an EBAN account to receive euro into from their customers whenever they sell crypto to private individuals. If they go to a bank and say, hello, my name is such and such, I would like a corporate account, the bank says, sure, what does your company do? And as soon as you say something with crypto, the bank will say, no way. You know, and that's actually also one reason that we found it. We had another founder who had such a website, and he'd personally contacted every single bank in Denmark and had exactly that conversation. Can I have a corporate account? Yes, of course. What does your company do? Well, I sell Bitcoin. Well, go away, right? And he had go to great lengths to make sure that he was compliant. He'd spend plus 50,000 euro with a very reputable Danish law firm to have them help him write his AML policies. He was registered with the Danish FSA. You know, he did everything by the book, but the banks didn't even want to look at his documentation package because they said, we know that risk and compliance will say no. So it's a waste of our time to even look at whatever documentation you have proving that you are a legitimate player.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that you introduced your customers and their problem, we're right at the particular phenomenon we're seeking to disentangle today. That is, your customers are apparently crypto SMEs, and the problem is their banking, respectively debanking in the industry. And that brings us to the vital question of why we are talking today in the first place. So can you elaborate a bit on the issues your customers have actually? And the problem you're solving.
Yeah, yeah. So again, you know, Januar was founded almost 5 years ago now. And of course, back then, the issue was larger. But even though we're seeing banks today start offering crypto products, they're usually only offering, you know, maybe they're not blocking consumers from sending funds to Kraken or Coinbase, or maybe they, on some of them, are even allowing consumers to start trading crypto directly with the bank. But if a crypto company comes to them and say, I want a corporate account to run my crypto business, they will, to a very large extent, still say no. And that is the problem that we're solving, right? So it still is a problem, even though there's a lot of, you know, you can find a lot of lists with crypto-friendly banks, those kind of things. But that's predominantly for consumers who want to interact with crypto. The banks won't block that. But if you try to run a crypto company, there's still almost no banks. And we are solving that problem.
Marcus, how do you solve that problem? So do you sit then in between these players and the regular banks? Or how can we imagine your role in that whole picture?
Yes. So I just realized I haven't actually introduced Janua yet. So Janua is a Danish payment institution. So we're licensed by the Danish FSA under PSD2. And we've passport our license to all 30 EEA countries. And we are what's called an account-bearing payment institution, which means that we are licensed to issue IBANs or EVANs. So that means that we have a correspondent bank who issues us an account and then allows us to issue what's called virtual IBANs. So it functions the same as an IBAN. I mean, to you, to our customers, they won't know the difference. It's only, you know, in our internal infrastructure that there's a difference between an actual IBAN and a virtual IBAN. But for our customers, it will look and feel the same as an IBAN if they got a bank account at the local bank. And it's also a named IBAN, which is important because we know that large exchanges like Kraken are matching account holder names with the account holder of the exchange account. So if you have an account, and for instance, it said Janua is the account holder, and you try to send funds from that account to Kraken, Kraken will block that transaction because they'll see that the account name on the account you have with Kraken, which has your name, does not match the account with Janua that has Janua's name. So that is why we are very happy to be able to actually provide IBAN accounts that have the name of our customer.
So you take over that risk of acceptance of these players, which leads me to the question, what does your correspondent bank say to that fact? So are they really cool with that? Or I could imagine they say, okay, actually, I'm taking over the risk. And how good is the check that Janua does to their clients? Who is your correspondent bank, if you're allowed to talk about that?
I won't say who our correspondent bank is, but I can say that we have a close relationship with our correspondent bank. You know, they're giving us more oversight than the Danish regulator.
Okay. I think they should. They should.
Yeah, no, and it's fair, right? And there are cases, you know, where they come to us and say that, oh, you know, you need to offboard this customer. And then we will say, okay, please tell us why. And we will have some arguments. For instance, we've had some discussions about the Czech VASPs, because in Czech Republic, there's no such thing as a VASP. So they haven't implemented the AML directive in a way that the rest of the euro has implemented it, where you get a VASP registration with the FSA. Instead, you get a trade license that has, where you kind of tick off a box that says, you know, crypto and other things. So it's not a VASP registration in the legal sense. And we've had some long discussions with our correspondent bank whether we could then be allowed to provide accounts to Czech VASPs, because their opinion was that they were operating illegally because they didn't have a VASP registration, where we've then come to explain to them that, well, there's no such thing as a VASP registration in Czech Republic, but we can document that they all have this trade license, which is, you know, what you need. And there are other things in the same manner where, you know, we're actually going in and protecting our customers to the extent that if they were with any other bank, they might have been offboarded multiple times.
So your focus is very much on Europe, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
I think we need to talk a bit about the status of Denmark in Europe, because Denmark is part of the EU, but you opted out of the euro as a currency, kept some sovereignty, which is not a bad decision in these days to keep some sovereignty. Can you tell us a bit about the implications of this and what it means to financial regulation and maybe MiCA specifically?
I mean, MiCA is applied the same throughout all of EU. So there's no differentiation between being part of the euro and not being part of the euro. The only countries where there is a difference, that's the three EEA countries that are not part of EU. So that's Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein, I think, where they have to implement a national interpretation of MiCA in the national law. And that's because MiCA is a regulation and not a directive. So there's, then it becomes a legal technical stuff where the difference between regulations and directives. But
So if you have clients or partners from the Eurozone, that's not a problem with you being in Denmark. So you are fully integrated into the MiCA rules.
Yes. And we issue Euro accounts that are SEP Instant enabled. So we have SEP Instant accounts.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. Maybe one more question about Jandra. Yes. Why that name? I think everybody might remember it, but it's hard to Google. So what did you drive into this naming?
It's actually a quite cool story. So we hired a branding agency to help us come up with the name and the whole branding framework and all those things. And we found out that the months are named after Roman gods. Not many people know that, but some people, at least in the Nordics, it's common knowledge that the weekdays are named after the Norse gods. Right, so Friday is named after Freya, Thursday is named after Thor, and so on. And it's actually the same with the months, but they're named after the Roman gods. And the month of January is named after the Roman god Janus. Janus was the god with two faces, one looking into the future, one looking into the past. And he's actually the god of bridges and transitions, both in physical form and metaphorically. So he's the god of change and new things, but he's also the god of gateways and bridges. So if you go to Rome, you'll actually see this image of a two-faced god on all the big gateways of the old buildings and all the old bridges and all those things. And that's the face of Janus, the two faces of Janus. And we thought that it was natural that we... trying to build the bridge between traditional finance and new digital finance, that we had Janus, it kind of resembled us, that we would both be the bridge between two worlds, but we would also sort of be the gateway, keeping the bad actors of the crypto industry out of the traditional financial world. So it becomes double in that sense. And then coincidentally, according to Roman mythology, Janus is also the god who invented coins, right? So
That's cool.
Really funny.
I love how you bring biology and methodology to the hardcore quantitative and technological crypto space.
Yeah.
Super
creative. Really cool.
We didn't plan to go that deep, but a really nice surprise that you have such a good answer to this very obvious question.
Yeah.
but maybe going a bit deeper into your product offering. So I understand virtual IBANs. I use them also very often. I think that's a great feature for bridging if you're in the SEPA system. Do you also support instant SEPA by now?
Yes.
Is that part of your feature set?
Yes.
That's very cool. So in seconds, you can actually go in and outside of crypto and fiat currency. So I guess what that means is a wallet of your client is then linked to that virtual IBAN for our users, just to better understand it. And you magically convert a regular euro into a stablecoin euro in that wallet. Is that right?
Not magically. No. So we've built a platform where it looks like a wet bank. Of course, now I'm the chief compliance officer, so I have to state that we are not a bank. So we don't have a bank license, so we can't call ourselves a bank, or we can't reference our services in any way relations to a bank. Otherwise, the Danish FSA is going to get angry at us. But we've built a platform which resembles a web bank, where you have your account. So for companies, they would have their OPEX account, they would have their salary account, they would have their customer account to collect and receive customer payments, those sort of things. And they might have that in multiple currencies, right? So we could provide a DKK account, a Euro account, a USD account. And then underneath those fiat accounts, you would just have your BTC account, your ETH account, your SOL account, your USDC, your EURC account. And then you can send and receive in all of those currencies, fiat and crypto alike, and you can convert between them seamlessly. So we are not providing a wallet or anything like that, that then when you send euro to the IBAN, it automatically gets converted into what? That's not how it works. You have actual individual currency accounts for each currencies. And in that setup, we don't really distinguish between fiat and crypto. So we want to make crypto feel as just another fiat currency.
Okay, which leads me to the question. At a certain point, there will happen a conversion, I guess, between fiat and the corresponding stablecoin.
Only if people initiate a conversion.
Not. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, now there's coming some new things in terms of safeguarding and stuff where, we might do things to make some kind of auto conversion end of next business day if funds have come in and stuff. But that's for regulatory reasons. The way we want to do it is that you receive euro to your euro account, it stays on your euro account, and you can decide whether to convert it or not. And then you can send it onward from that account. We offer crypto conversion as part of our full stack financial infrastructure. But we have a lot of customers who have existing infrastructure and existing, customer relationship with crypto exchanges and liquidity venues and those sort of things. And they will just receive customer payments to the euro account, and then they will make a euro transaction out to their external liquidity venue, and they will do the conversion there. And that's okay with us as well.
So you have one foot in both worlds. So you would rather say, okay, there's a fiat foot and there's a crypto foot. Let's put it like that. So you don't necessarily or explicitly work with stablecoins as a primary means of action. They might play a role in conversions or something like that. Mm-hmm. But actually, the user doesn't see that firsthand. Or how can I imagine that part?
Well, I mean, we offer stablecoins as any other currency, right? So the user can decide to convert the euro into USDC. They can also decide to convert it into USDC, where we're actually very cheap compared to some large exchanges in Europe. Again, it's just different currencies.
I think that's quite interesting, because some players in the market try to abstract away the fact that actually there's a stablecoin and which stablecoin. So if I would send two different euro stablecoins to my January account, I would see two different currencies, what would happen?
Yeah, so at the moment you would have a euro account, you would have a EURC account, EURQ or EURAU or whatever stablecoin that you prefer to use. Yeah, so you'd have that as separate, and then you can convert between them the way
so
it is.
The user
now
has full control about what's going on there with their currency, which might have advantages or disadvantages as soon as they are accepted as cash equivalents. I think you might reconsider that, but interesting.
Yeah, and we have talked about abstracting it away, but there's a lot of a risk on us. Then if we abstract that layer away and we decide to use Circle as the primary stablecoin and Circle then DPEX, right? Then the risk is on us, because we have decided which stablecoin to hold the customer funds in, and that have been abstracted away. Where if the customer have decided themselves which stablecoins do they want, which stablecoins do they trust, right? Then it's their decision, but that also means that it's their risk. So I'm not saying that we will never abstract it away. We have talked about it. It's something that we are always considering, and if there's a customer demand for it, we can build it. But at the moment, it's not a path that we've decided to go down.
Imagine your heater not only keeping you warm, but also earning you Bitcoin at the same time. That's exactly what the Ofen 2 by 21 Energy does. This isn't science fiction, it's Austrian engineering. The Ofen 2 is essentially a Bitcoin mining heater. It converts 1,000 watts of electricity into 100% heat, heats rooms of up to 50 square meters, and while it heats, it uses the energy twice. It mines Bitcoin for you. And the best part? True plug and play. You don't need any technical knowledge at all. Just plug it in, connect it to the 21 Energy app via Wi-Fi. Done in 3 minutes. It's whisper quiet and looks absolutely stunning. Premium steel design, made in Austria. Instead of just consuming energy, you get cash back in Bitcoin. Use your energy twice. Get the Ofen 2 at 21energy.com.
As we understood so far, your mission is really the fighting the debanking of crypto SMEs, or put otherwise, providing them at least the basic banking services they struggle to find.
Payment services, yes.
Yeah. How alone are you on that mission? So are there hundreds of companies in the European Union or even globally providing exactly these payment services?
No.
Or
no, not at all.
Are you really unique in that
position? No, we are really unique in that position. We are, there's maybe a handful of entities around Euro where, there's a couple Swiss banks, there's a UK EMI, there's a, a Lithuanian bank, and then there are some other PIs and EMIs in Eastern Europe. But I know that we are the only one in Denmark, and I think there's also you know, a bank in Liechtenstein or something like that. So we do have competitors, but they're often focusing on larger corporations, that kind of stuff. So they will have, you know, very large onboarding fees and monthly account fees and those kind of things, where we are targeting the SME market. Then there's other things where we have built the full stack financial solution. So you have the different currencies and they function interchangeably. And that provides us with another benefit. EBA came out this summer and said that stablecoins are now considered funds. So in order for CASPs to provide stablecoin services, stablecoin custody, stablecoin transfers, they need a PSD2 license in addition to their CASP license. And not a lot of people in the industry know this or have realized the consequence of this. But actually, if you as a CASP, you have a CASP license, if you accept stablecoin pay-ins or stablecoin payouts when doing crypto transactions, you need a PSD2 license. If you don't have a PSD2 license or a partner like Yanoar, you will get fined from the 1st of March 2026. And we have a PSD2 license. And I can say, honestly, it's impossible to get a PSD2 license before 1st of March. I don't think anyone will disagree with me on that. Another thing that's important to note is that the whole reason we founded Yanoar was to solve the debanking issue, right? And now, while trying to solve that, we get a PSD2 license. We build crypto on top of that. We're in the final stages of getting our MiCA license, which will make us one of the only dual license entities in Europe. And then EBA comes and throw this curveball at the industry and say, oh, by the way, if you want to do stablecoins, you have to get a dual license or find a partner who has a dual license. And, you know, it's not something that we ever planned for. It just happened to be that we're in the right place at the right time to solve one more industry problem. It's really cool that we were built to solve a core problem of the industry. And now we get to solve another problem of the industry, right? And by chance, almost.
So you're served with the next problem.
Yeah.
Accidentally, if you want. So how's the reaction of the market? Actually, you were the first, and actually, there was one of the triggers for this podcast episode, actually, when we talked about that problem. Mm. We also wanted to spread that news, actually, because yeah. I wasn't aware of that. How's the reaction of the industry, of these CASP players? Are they aware? Are they fighting against it, or it's quite quiet in the market? Everybody's celebrating MiCA and stablecoins and the US push, yeah. And now you come along and say, actually, you might be out of business in March if you don't act quickly.
Yeah, exactly, and it's completely crazy. And there have been pushback, so there are some industry actors or industry organizations that are pushing back and trying to get the deadline extended and so on. Also, because if you read the EBA no action letter from this summer and you read between the lines, you know, they're not really happy with this solution. I don't think anybody's happy with the solution. And they're almost saying that this should have been taken into account when writing MiCA. But since it weren't, this is, you know, our hands are tied to interpret it in this way and to handle it in this way. And they hope that it can be solved with PSD3. But if it can't be solved with PSD3, then they think Europe should push up the implementation of MiCA 2 to solve it in that regulation. So that's basically what
it is. And it's also funny because 1 year ago, we all celebrated the partial go live of MiCA, yeah. And then the full go live of it, and describing the regulatory advantages we have here in Europe. And now the flip has really, the coin has really flipped in that we have yet another regulatory intricacy, that is this new EBA licensing requirement, making stablecoin business or running a CASP business like a crypto exchange trickier now, although it's good business for you at Yanoar, of course. And now in the US, with the Genius regulation, they are now in the place of not overcomplicating it and moving fast. I know I'm quite bringing in a anti-regulation perspective here, so do feel free to challenge that. But yeah, it's kind of disappointing to see that all the regulatory advantages seem to have gone.
I would say personally, I think that MiCA is a decent to good core regulation. The only thing that I'm really missing in MiCA is the possibility of getting a limited CASP license. So when we initially got our PSD2 license, we got a limited payment license, which allowed us to operate with a cap on the volumes we could process. And it wasn't possible to passport. So we could only operate within Denmark. And then we upgraded that to a full PSD2 license, which we could then passport, and there were no caps. And I'm missing that limited CASP license where you can have a, you know, one or two man company operating a website selling crypto within your own country and with a cap on how much volume you can process before you have to upgrade to the full license. I'm really missing that within Mika, because Mika is effectively, you know, removing the entire underforest of innovation in crypto, because the threshold for getting a license is so high. So that's my only real issue with Mika. Other than that, I think Mika is good. The problem is that the ESA, so ESMA and EBA, then come afterwards and write their guidelines and RTSs and stuff on how they interpret Mika. And there's a lot of guidelines they have written where they actually go above and beyond what was the intention of Mika and give even stricter, even tighter guidelines on how we as CASPs have to operate, you know, and that is a problem. But again, Genius Act is also just the core regulation. So you could have the same in the US, where now everybody's like, oh, Genius is so good. And then, you know, the SEC and all the other agencies go in and write the second level regulation on how they interpret and how Genius Act should be implemented into daily operations that might be much stricter, might be less fantastic.
Yeah, fair enough. So the second order effects, yeah, they were to be expected. And the fact that we celebrated Mika that much was maybe a bit naive then, or many analyses just didn't anticipate that other regulators or agencies would come around the corner and give a good business opportunity to you and to Janua, but make it tougher to run a crypto exchange or any CASP business than in Europe.
Yeah, I mean...
And I, Marcus, heard very similar stories from startup founders in Germany who say, actually, you need so much money to get that Mika license and your operations up before having product market fit. Mm. And actually, that's how startups work. You need to be lean at getting at a certain break even and satisfying your investors. Mm. And I think that's the point that we also had in other podcasts here, that you need to keep the business opportunities open.
Yeah.
I think that's what we sometimes forget in Europe, that there is nothing to regulate if there is no business.
No.
and we need these startups.
Yeah.
The old companies have problems to prevail, actually, with all the competition from other countries. We want to celebrate the startup ecosystem, and then we create regulation that even doesn't give birth to any startups anymore. You need to have strong banks. So we see all the movements in the stablecoin industry, but usually there are big players who create consortia, have a lot of money behind them. They need seven-digit numbers just for go-to-market, and then again seven-digit numbers for paying lawyers and getting the regulatory aspects right. I think that's a reminder to all these people who really write the rules. That we might kill ourselves before even getting started. And then it's not about investor protection, because there are no investors who can invest, actually.
No, that's true. And you need to find the balance, right? I mean, personally, I think that, again, I was also one of the ones that applauded Mika, because there was an issue in the market, right? Again, if we want, but I guess it also depends on what you want for the industry, right? Because if you want user-wide adoption worldwide adoption of crypto in one way or the other, you know, if I want my mom to pay with stablecoins instead of her Visa card, you know, then you need to have consumer protection in place. If you want pension funds to invest in crypto as they do shares, you need to have market manipulation regulation in place, those sort of things. Otherwise, they will opt out. And we need to realize that even though there's a lot of people in the crypto industry who are tech people and don't have any financial experience, these are financial instruments that you are creating and trading. So, of course, there should be a level playing field between the crypto industry and the financial industry. I don't see a reason why a crypto exchange should not have the same regulation as a stock exchange. And with any other, and now that, you know, if you buy into the fact that crypto is finance, you need to know that in banking, you've always talked about banks being the mediators of trust. So that is the most important thing a bank does. It doesn't matter about lending or anything, but banks create trust. And that is what they're essentially selling. And I think that having regulation in place will help the industry become more trustworthy. And I think that that will benefit the industry long term. When Trump repealed all of the regulation, all the things SEC had done in the past years, I was afraid that it would open the floodgates for all the scammers of the crypto world moving to the US. And it might create a lot of investments. It might create a lot of activity initially. But if it turns out that 90% of it is criminal, then the rest of the population that haven't adopted crypto yet, they will go back and say, as they did in 14, oh, it's only for criminals, I'm not going to touch it. And then even though we have a big blowout or a big increase initially, long term, it might be a deficit. Or just, if, you know, depending on how Trump, if Trump decides to take a third term or anything, whatever, you know, people speculate in, right? And crypto somehow is put in relationship with Trump, you know, that could also create some negative effects for crypto. I mean, you could just see what happened to the Tesla stock after Elon Musk started to be the side man of Trump, right? So it's not all good, everything that's happening in the US. I think I applaud that it is happening and that we're seeing a lot of institutional players now implementing stablecoins and actually doing things in the industry. And I think that is beneficial. But for the long term and for the wide adoption of everyday people, I think the jury is still out.
I think we totally agree to that take. So I couldn't agree more to that, to get this level playing field. But maybe going back to your role now. So you have this once in a lifetime opportunity that a strict ESMA regulation actually plays accidentally into your cards.
Yes.
But you also stated that you are very thorough with checking your clients, actually.
Yes.
So now I could imagine the next 3 months, the floodgates are open. Many, many CASPs contacting you guys. You have a name at risk if you are too open and too willing to accept maybe also shady players.
Yeah.
So what's your operational action these days? How do you go about that? Many potential clients calling you. It's a big business opportunity.
Yeah.
But you, I imagine you need to balance that out.
Definitely.
With your existing business, with your relationship with your correspondent bank, etc.
Yeah.
How do you go about that one?
Well, we are being diligent as ever, and you know, we are having, even though we've staffed up, we're still very busy. You know, so that's that's always interesting. And then we're also getting, you know, calls from customers that we've never thought we would be able to land as a customer, right? So we have some very large entities that are calling us and asking for our EMT prime custody service that allows them to continue to provide EMT services to their customers using us as a prime custodian. So we will issue a custody wallet to them, which they can then use as an omnibus wallet for issuing receiving addresses to their customers. And then they have to write into the terms of services that they're using Yanoa as a third-party facilitator for their EMT flow. And again, normally we've been focused on the SME market on the crypto industry, but now we have some really large institutions that are reaching out to us. So that's incredible. And then we hope
how big is January by now? Because that will be the first question if a large player contacts you and
wants to actually
understand the counterparty risk.
The talks I've had with them, they haven't asked that. They just
okay, interesting.
Yeah, no, but I mean, so we had a talk with one customer, right? And first they came in and said, "Oh, we want a pure agency model where you just sort of rubber stamp our transactions." And we said, "We can't do that. That's not going to happen." You know, that basically the way we interpret it goes against the intention of eBay when they made the no action letter. So we went with that and say, "Okay, we have this solution." You know, and then they came back, no, that's not what we wanted. Then a few days went, and they came back, said, okay, we'll do the solution, but you're very expensive. I said, well, we think we're cheap. It would cost what it costs. And then they came back a few days later, okay, the price is acceptable, right? So I think it's also a matter of us being one of the only entities in Europe that actually has this offering. Because I know, even as I said, there are other PSPs in the market, but some of our competitors in the fiat space, that provide IBANs to crypto companies. They don't have the crypto layer on top of it where they can issue wallets. And then there are others that do the same, but they have different license structures. They have different ways of working. So they're not either comfortable or not able to provide this EMT prime custody service that we offer that allow CASPs to continue offering EMT services to their customers.
Yes, we nicely touched upon how you actually tackle the debanking and the licensing issues in the space. Maybe if we move to a bit of an outlook in the future. So you already said yourself that debanking is a decreasing problem. So getting banking access is not as much of a problem anymore as it was probably 5 years ago. And then I also foresee that ever more PSD2 licensees will be issued. So if we are now serious or rigorous, we might assume that, let's say, in 5 years, both of the problems you tackle might not be as commercially viable anymore as they are today. So is there any concern of yours? And are you already reconsidering your business model for the future? Or is for now these two opportunities enough for you to run your business and you're not concerned about the future?
I'm not concerned about the future. We have the first mover advantage or whatever you want to call it, right? And especially now with this EMT issue that has come towards the industry where we have the solution, we are hopefully able to gain a significant market share so that even though other PSPs and banks start opening up for crypto activity, we will be a large enough player. We will be able to continue operating and serving our customers. I think it's also important to know, again, we have a correspondent bank and they are one of the only banks in Europe that service crypto customers, and they are servicing some large exchanges and stuff. But the kind of questions we get from them regarding our customers, it just shows us how important it is as a crypto company to have a bank or have a financial partner that understands the industry and understands what you're doing. Right. So, yeah.
So do you understand your role in 5 years more as one of as it is today, focused on banking and licensing? Or is there any major next growth step for you that is more use cases or a geographic expansion?
There's plenty of path we could take to grow Yanoa further. I think what we want to do next is that if we go back to the forest or ecosystem analogy, right? So first it was Bitcoin wasteland, full of crime, wild west kind of things. Then Chainalysis came and kind of cleaned up the industry. Then the next thing that needed to be done was we needed to solve the debanking issue of the industry, and that's why Yanoa was founded. So we kind of solved that, or still in the process of solving that, but that is not enough to get to the full tokenization of financial assets, because if you tokenize all financial assets, if you have to do a bank transfer in order to pay for that financial asset, right? It doesn't work. It still doesn't work. It only works once you have on-chain payment methods, so that you can do an on-chain atomic swap of the financial assets for a payment. So that is why we believe that the next step in the ecosystem evolution of crypto and blockchains, that is stablecoins. So we are focusing very much on stablecoins because we do believe that stablecoin adoption will be the catalyst that will allow the next evolutional stage for full tokenization. But what we're seeing now in the stablecoin industry is that we're seeing a sort of gold rush where everybody wants to build their own stablecoin, right? And what we
if you allow, I just refer to our last news episode, which is titled something like "Yet Another Stablecoin." Yeah. So our news episodes this month are filled with stablecoin announcements or issuances.
Exactly.
And yeah, so you're just very right.
And the reason that everybody wants to build their own stablecoin is that everybody has the vision that if I'm able to win the stablecoin war and be the only stablecoin left in the world, then I will handle all the transactions in the world and I'll become rich and famous, right? But when everybody tries to play that game, there's going to be a lot of fragmentation and there will be a huge need for interoperability. And Yanoa have taken a strategic decision to, instead of trying to run to the gold rush and create our own stablecoin, we want to be the ones selling picks and shovels. So we are focusing on building the integration layer between all the different stablecoins. So we plan to do a Series A in the spring, and with the funds from that, we hope to be able to build that integration layer. So we are already minting partner with Circle. We are talking, we are onboarding with two other European stablecoin issuers to become their official minting partners. We are in talks with some of the large US stablecoin payment networks. We're in talks with, we are a design partner with Ubix, who do like a stablecoin clearing for financial institutions. So we are trying to build direct integrations and become official minting partners with all the largest stablecoins and become integrated with all the different payment stablecoin payment networks so that we can become the integration layer. Because if Siemens, you know, wants to send funds to a subsidiary or a vendor in Malaysia or something like that, you know, they might have a relationship with Circle or All Unity. But in Malaysia, it might be Tether that's the dominating stablecoin, right? So the even though they're using stablecoins, you know, those stablecoins need to match and they need to do some kind of conversion. It could also just be that even if Malaysia uses Circle, it might be that in Malaysia, Polygon is the dominating blockchain, but in Europe, it's Ether or Ethereum that's the dominating blockchain. So you still need to make that conversion. And that's where Yanoa tried to build the integration layer by doing direct integrations with all the different actors so that both Web3 and Web2 companies don't have to build those integrations, but they can just get an account with Yanoa and then they have access to everything at once.
Very visionary. That's really cool. So finally, we got back to stablecoins.
Yes.
would have been crazy if we didn't focus on that very topic.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, this also ties into our dual license and our EMT offering, right? Because the fact that we have that dual license means that when we build this integration layer, you know, we are actually allowed to provide stablecoin custodial wallets to all of these entities. So it sort of becomes natural that we act as the integration layer into the full fragmented world of stablecoins.
That's a shark tank, I think. So I wish you all good luck for that one, because nobody except you tries to play that role, I guess. So it will be interesting to see. I think you come from a very interesting angle with these licensees and with this long experience and with this focus on being correct and setting the rules and having these two faces into the crypto world and the traditional financial world. I think that's are good preconditions actually to succeed in there. But many other players try to compete with deep pockets. So wish you good luck in that one, Marcus.
Thank you very much.
So I think we need to come to an end. We're also already quite some time into this podcast. Is there any question we should have asked you and we didn't, Marcus?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered why Yanoa was created. You know, what we're doing and how we're doing it and why it matters. You know, and why I'm being interviewed right now, which is the EMT product that we've recently launched, right? Because by 1st of March, CASPs will get fines if they provide stablecoin services without a partner.
Closing, I have one idea where we didn't go too deep. Maybe every bank is still asking for use cases. So if we touch that for a final note, so what are the three most important use cases on a high level that you currently support actually with January?
That we support with Yanoa. Well, with Yanoa, the use case is that we enable CASPs and VASPs to get a Euro account where they can receive customer payments, right? That's number one. So that's use cases that Yanoa provides. And then, of course, full stack financial services where you can send and receive crypto and fiat and convert between them seamlessly as if it was just one. We have a really good API that allows you to automate that process as well. We have one customer who said that by getting a Yanner account, they were able to fully automate 8 manual steps because previously they had to receive funds to the bank, send that to the exchange, make the conversion, send it out, those kind of things. But with the Yanner API, they could do everything at Yanner fully automated.
Maybe let me ask the question a bit more precisely. So from a client view, what are the use cases? So I don't want to go on the low level. I think we handled that properly, but which kind of financial services do your clients actually offer on top of your services? That was more my question.
Okay. Yeah. So use cases for crypto in general that our customers service. Okay. Yeah. So as I said, most of our customers are brokers and exchanges who sell crypto. So that would be the investing part. Again, my vision for where crypto is going and where crypto and blockchain is going to revolutionize the world, that is tokenized financial assets. So, you know, I'm personally reaching out to companies like 21X and other tokenization platforms because I think it's really interesting what they do, and I would love to support, you know, their work, not only 21X but anyone else, you know. So that's where I see everything is going, and I would love to support them. But we support the ecosystem overall. We have, you know, token issuers who do carbon credits. We have some independent developers who like to invoice in stablecoins or invoice in crypto. We have investment funds and family office who wants to invest in crypto. I mean, so we're covering a very wide base. We also have a few foundations who founded some DAOs and those kind of things. So we have a very wide coverage of anything that's related to crypto. In the future, we would very much like to have more traditional companies who start to see the benefit of using stablecoins for global payments. So we are already in talks with some companies, but you know, this type of customer relationship mostly go through consultants and lawyers and those kind of things that are credible and that these companies trust, because crypto and stablecoins is very new for these traditional companies, right? So they want to talk with someone who trusts, who can tell them, well, if you use this, that, you know, you can save a lot of money on your international transfers and those kind of things. And I think that is an important feature of stablecoins. Actually, I attended a webinar with EY where the EY head of digital asset research said that they had done an internal study that if EY used stablecoins for all their intergroup transactions, they would save $100 million a year. Right? That's
so, Marco, if you do that move, you would become an immediate competitor of SAP's Digital Currency Hub. So challenge accepted.
No, but I mean
everybody.
I talked with you previously, Michel. You know, we would love to be a vendor because the S&P Digital Currency Hub, you know, that's self-custody. Because you don't want to hold a license. So you don't want to be a financial entity that's facilitating the transactions. You want to be the software layer on top of that. But we would like to be that custodian that can connect with SAP so that your customers don't have to manage their own keys and have to set up security rules and all of those things that can be rather complex and rather risky to do as a large corporate if you don't know what you're doing. It's much easier for companies like that to have a turnkey solution where they get an account with Yanner and then it just works, right? They have the account, they can send and receive, they can convert, and it's automatically integrated to the SAP platform. We would very much like to do that integration. But we can talk about that afterwards.
Lovely. Yeah, let's explore, Marcus. So if you allow one closing question from my end, so where can people find you to learn more about your thinking and about your business?
Yeah, so they can go to januar.com and it's spelled like the month in German. So just januar.com, that's our website. And they can read more about our products and services. We also have a resources page where I've shared some white papers on the intersection between MiCA and PSD2, and read more about how this overlap impacts not only EMTs, which has been the focus of today's talk, but also crypto payments, right? So for instance, all of these crypto payment cards, where you get a Visa account, with a Bitcoin balance, and then you can go to the store, you can pay with that. That's actually a payment and requires a PSD2 license. So there are some things there that people need to think about if they want to provide these services. But we can help with that as well, and people can read more about it in the white paper. For me personally, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So you can try and find me on LinkedIn. I'm the only one with my name, but it does contain a Danish letter, which is very difficult to type in.
Super cool. Yeah, we'll make sure we provide all these information in the show notes, of course. And with that, if either Stefan or you, Markus, don't have any final thoughts, thank you for listening, dear audience, to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll. Thanks for your insights today, Markus, and for helping us understand how to solve banking issues of CASPs or crypto startups and how to offer EMT licensing services. Do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English. For details, check the show notes. And Markus, this is a invitation to join at least the English-speaking Telegram channel, where, of course, these debanking and licensing issues are discussed too. Do visit our website bfrr.info for detailed analysis and complete show notes from this episode. And of course, do make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital money to the world. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.